Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophonous cavalcade of conversation. I hope you're all still basking in the afterglow of a romantic evening on Valentine's Day a few evenings ago. We are, if anything, hopeless romantics here at Coast to Coast, so that date always gets circled on the calendar. And, you know, since many of you have President's Day on your calendars tomorrow, at least some of you will be able to stay up late with us tonight, sleep in late tomorrow, stay home, goof off. Tonight's program will make it tough to sleep at all, or at least that's our intention. We all remember the term night stalker. That's the chilling name for an infamous killer who kind of reeked of satanic intensity and twisted motives. Richard Ramirez, remember that name? He was caught, as we all know, but the original night stalker, the deadly and insidious killer who first had that sinister moniker, was never caught. He's still out there somewhere. He was known by several nicknames as his infamy grew and as the list of crimes that were attributed to him also grew. He was the East Bay rapist, I think known for something like 120 burglaries that led to 45 known rape cases. I think they figure he committed something like a dozen murders that they know of. He terrorized several communities in California. He defied police. As a new book explained, he couldn't be tracked, he couldn't be found, he couldn't be stopped. This new book reviews the case files from what's called the Golden State Killer, a.k.a. the original Night Stalker, and maybe someone listening tonight can add some information to the search for this vile murderer. That's coming up at the second half tonight. And if we get a chance, we'll play an audio recording of his voice, believed to be left on as a warning on an answer machine of one of his intended victims. First, though, a different kind of mystery. It involves owls. Those big-eyed birds have a special place in mythology, in folklore, and in history. But for our purposes, there is another connection of note. Owls and close encounters, call them abduction experiences, missing time, screen memories. Owls pop up over and over, often as part of larger examples of strange synchronicity-type events. They're mystical, magical, spooky, yet inspirational. The stories collected by Mike Cleland will grab you and won't let go. You know, to my surprise, Mike has not been on the program until tonight, but we're about to rectify that. He's written two books on the topic, including his latest, Stories from the Messengers. If you've had your own experiences with owls, along the lines of what we're about to talk about, we may want to hear them a little bit later. I'll save some time and get some calls in toward the end of Mike's segment. Mike will be here in just a couple of minutes to share those amazing stories with us. Our webmaster, Lex, and I have put together our usual assortment of news items and oddities culled from various media sources around the world. We call it Knapp's News. You can find it on the Coast to Coast website. Look for the big photo of Salvador Dali posing with a wax likeness of himself. The story there is about the grisly origin of the world's most famous wax museum, plus a cool photo essay about an artist who photographs the world's oldest trees. Awesome shots in there. A science adventure story is unfolding in the deserts of Oman. The place kind of looks like Tatooine from the Star Wars movie. It's where scientists are learning how tough it would be to survive on the surface of Mars, and the place looks remarkably like Mars. We also have a think piece about whether we are actually ready to have confirmation of ET life. We think we're ready. Isn't that what we always say on this program? We'd like to know. We think we're ready to have confirmation that ETs are out there or that they're here. I suppose it might depend on what the ultimate truth is, whether we're ready or not. Oh, we have two stories that relate to human memory. I think will be directly related to the first half of tonight's story with these owl encounters, how memories are formed, some remarkable research being done on human brains. DARPA, for example, wants to hack the brain. That's their term. Hack the brain and upload certain skills. I can think of several I'd like to learn, plus some promising new research on possible restoration or enhancement of memory for those of us who are slowly losing it. I guess we can all relate to that. Those stories and more in Naps News. And while you're on the website, check out how to become a Coast Insider. The cost is pennies a day, gives you access to a vast archive of previous programs, classic interviews and episodes that you can listen to as often as you want, anytime you want. It's a great deal, and insiders get other benefits as well. And you can see where to subscribe to George Norrie's TV program, Beyond Belief, which covers a lot of the same topic material we cover on this program. Lots of good info on the Coast website. Check it out when you get a moment. With that, let's assume the position. Bring in the dog and cat, put on a pot of Joe, slip into those flannel jammies and bunny slippers, plop down in that easy chair, turn down the lights, and turn up the radio, because we're about ready to rumble. In a moment, owls, abductions, synchronicity, stories from the messengers. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. You know, we cover so many strange topics on this program, UFOs and aliens and unknown creatures and poltergeists. And I think there's a tendency among the folks who research these subjects to try and fit things into a scientific paradigm to, you know, to eventually achieve recognition or acceptance from the scientific community at large, to fit these things into definable, measurable boxes, when the facts often suggest otherwise. The experiences that we explore here often defy scientific explanation, that fit into some other category, some measure of reality that's not so easily weighed or measured or quantified. I've had this book, The Messengers, on my to-do list for a while now. Finally got around to ordering a copy, and boom, I find out there's a new volume. Just came out, a follow-up book that stands on its own. Stories from The Messengers. And at the center of both of these are tales that involve owls. Those of you who've read Whitley Strieber's classic Communion might be getting goosebumps right now. You'll remember that owls play a major role in that story. In fact, Whitley wrote the foreword to the second book. The principal author is Mike Cleland, and this is his first time here on the program. Mike, great to have you here.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to be here.
You know, there's a section in one of the books, I'm not sure if it's the first or the second, but it's a piece of dialogue, an exchange that you have with a scientist friend of yours. And this guy tells you, hey, Mike, your approach isn't very scientific. And you respond by saying, hey, I'm not a scientist. And I love that because, you know, so many of these stories that we hear that you have collected do not fit into a neat little scientific box. They're something else. Do you remember that conversation?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I actually had to laugh, you know, what do I care? You know, like, that's the least of my concerns is being scientific. I do try to be organized. I do try to be thoughtful, and I do try to look for patterns, but you know, that's not my job to be a scientist. My job is more of a folklorist, where I'm collecting these stories, and in doing so, I'm kind of, you know, forced to conclude, you know, is exactly what you pointed out in the introduction, that there's something richer and more elusive about the nature of reality than I was taught in, you know, high school physics class.
How many stories do you think you've heard by now involving owls?
So I have no idea. It would be in the many, I would, you know, every 1,000, let's just say. Enough, you know, some of them, I mean, they all blur together because some of them are perfect. They just have the perfect essence of, you know, the owl showing up at just the right precise moment. Some of them are.
I should mention you got a website called Hidden Experience where you explore these events and connections, and people call in, and I guess you've got hundreds of hours of audio interviews with people who offer their take on this whole thing.
Yes, I was very dedicated to podcasting for about 6 years, and then I took on this book project, and that just took over everything. And so I put all my efforts into the first book, and then the follow-up book, which just came out today. It actually made its appearance on Kindle this morning.
So. Let's talk about owls. And, you know, the obvious question is going to be why owls, and we'll get to that in a moment. But, you know, you have a section in one of the books that talks about owls not as mythical, mystical beings, but just as awesome physical creatures, and they are.
They are amazing, yeah. I mean, so on a simple level, you know, owls are nocturnal animals, and they they cannot move their eyes the way we can move our eyes, right? So we have round eyeballs and we can hold our head still, but still turn our eyes right and left. Owls can't do that. And they have made up for that with this eerie head stability where they can rotate their head. Their eyes are always locked forward in one position. So that's where you get that eerie motion of the owl's head when it turns. No other bird really has that. And the reason is that their eyeball itself is shaped completely different. It's more of a mushroom shape, so it can't turn in the owl's head. That allows for just the surface of the interior of the retina can pack a lot more light sensing cones and rods, where that gives the owl an amazing ability to see at night. And that's something that anyone would recognize, even in ancient times, that an owl has the ability to fly in the darkness and in complete darkness. And there's really no other bird that can do that. And that ability has then become a metaphor for flying to other realms in the mythologies of the owl.
Well, and the metaphor is that they're wise. The word wise is always attached to owls, and the idea that they somehow have wisdom is, you find it in mythology and folklore all the way back through human history.
And that traces back in the West anyway to Athena, the Greek goddess of wisdom, who had a companion, little owl. So she was always portrayed with an owl at her side, and that's so the owl of so that's where we get that where that myth emerged from. My sense is that owls they certainly have a presence. You know, it's not like seeing a bunny rabbit when you see an owl in the wild. They have a very, very stoic and powerful presence in it, and it certainly comes across as emoting wisdom. I don't think they're necessarily any smarter than any other bird, but they certainly project a sort of wisdom and wiseness.
Can you share with us I don't need the whole history of owls, but a little bit more about where they do pop up in addition to Athena having an owl? I mean, owls in literature and mythology and movies and pop culture, separate from the topic that we're going to discuss tonight. They're all over the place.
Well, it's a common bird. So, yes, so there shouldn't be too unusual that they're all over the place, you know, but they seem to have in our pop culture shown up. It's not that they show up in spooky movies, which they certainly do, right? So if you want to generate a spooky scene in a movie, you know, you have a little kid's walking down the path at night and there's an owl hooting in the background. It just adds that ambiance of eeriness. And that's in Shakespeare, that's in the Bible. Owls show up, and as far as I can tell, they're just adding that tone of spookiness to a story. Owls also resonate with death in a lot of the world's cultures. They would be symbolic of death, especially the Native Americans of the Southwest have a very dark, ominous mystique about the owl, less so in other tribes in the Northeast and in other parts of North America. But, you know, so the owls not only show up in that context, in the sort of pop culture context of just creating something that's spooky, but they also show up in at times of death, in moments before death, and so that would be the two main categories of folklore that owls, you know, are noted for would be wisdom and death.
I'll share with you my only recent owl experience. It was in the Uinta Basin. We were on a little trip up there to Skinwalker Land. This is 2.5 months ago, with some Native Americans, with some members of the Ute tribe, and we went to a place called Dark Canyon, and it is well named. I mean, it is really dark out there. It's been the site of a lot of really strange stuff. And we get out of the vehicle, and we have apparently disturbed these owls that were in a nest who then took off and kept flying back around. We couldn't see them. We could just hear them making a whole bunch of racket. Were very upset with us. Now, we just kind of got a kick out of it. Oh, there's owls up here. The Utes who were with us took it much more seriously. They were very disturbed by it and wanted us to get the heck out of there.
That does not surprise me. Now, I have very few stories where owls are would be a harbinger for like doom or anything like that, a harbinger for something bad. They are certainly show up at the time, especially of death, after death, to the point where people will actually, an owl will show up after usually a parent dies. And then I have countless stories of people like walking up to the owl and talking to it as if it was their dead parent. But that that does not surprise me. Yes, the folklore and the traditions of the Southwest Indians treat the owl as something very ominous. In fact, I talked to someone, I think he was Navajo, and he said that the synonym, the owl, the word owl in his language, the native language, owl and sinister are the same words. So those are interchangeable.
As I said, I wanted to ask the question, why owls? But really, I should ask first, why owls for you? You have your own experience that you tell in the first book. And we got about 4 minutes before we go to the break. I know you had explained that it was kind of an extensive story, but go ahead and tell it. And if we need more time, we'll do it on the other side as well.
Yeah, just chop me off if I need to, or hurry
sure.
me up. Going back now 11 years ago, I think that's right, 12 years ago. Okay, 12 years ago, I was living out west, and I took a friend camping, someone I had actually never met. It was kind of a first date, and it was kind of a, which is I was living right near Grand Teton National Park. We went in the mountains for one night, and at a very profound moment, she was talking about God. She was like giving me her deepest definition of God as the sun was setting, and this owl showed up, and then a second owl, and then a third owl. And they hung out with us and flew around us and landed near us for the next few hours. It was this amazing, powerful thing. We literally lied down on the ground in the owls, because we were sleeping without a shelter under the stars. And the owls would like fly over our faces and blot out the stars for just 1 second. It was really remarkable. We went out for one night camping. A few nights later, I said, hey, let's go out one more time. Let's go out for one more night camping. And she said, great. And we did it, and almost the exact same thing happened again. The same person, almost the exact, three owls each time, three owls, and I'm convinced they were the same three owls, even though we were many miles from the location. And in that moment, I did not talk about it then because it just seemed too bizarre. I'm talking about it now. In that moment, there was a booming voice in my head that said, this has something to do with the UFOs. Both times I saw the owls with this woman, Kristen, the voice in my head said, this has something to do with the UFOs. And I sort of took it on as a mission, less out of, I mean, it was almost my own compulsions and my own obsessions. I took this on as a research project. And after that, I asked everyone I could who had either UFO experiences or was a UFO researcher, have you had any odd experiences with owls? And I was flooded. It's obviously not 100% of the people will have a story, but it's enough that there's a very real pattern.
You had something else, I think, on either the first or the second night where you're coming back down the trail and there's an ex-girlfriend you run into on the trail. There's some kind of synchronicity with owls there too, right?
Well, yes, and that event generated so many synchronicities, and they were all like surprisingly heartwarming. That when I bumped into that girlfriend on her pseudonym in the book is Carol, when I bumped into her, we had this small town, and we hadn't seen each other that much in many years, and we basically had the conversation we needed to have, and the conversation was, it was correct to break up, and we both went our separate ways. And everything was going good in both of our lives. It was really, really life-affirming conversation. So, yes, and that from that central hub or from that central core event of those three owls, I mean, the synchronicities from that point on were hitting me so hard and so – but the subtitle of the first book is Owls, Synchronicity, and the UFO Abductee. The power of those synchronicities forced me to really re-examine reality in a way that is fundamental, and the book is, there's almost two books. One part of the book is my research, and another part of the book is my own journey, my own story, and how I got to the point that I'm at now.
I mean, it's cool to see owls, three owls flying over you real low, and then it's cool to see them again a couple days later. miles away. But this somehow struck a chord with you. It struck a chord in at some deeper level, and that's sort of what set you off on this trail. And when we come back, we're going to get into what that trail involves. We're talking with Mike Cleland about his book, The Messengers, Owls, Synchronicity, and the UFO Abductee, and the newest book, which is called Stories from the Messengers. And we're going to hear some of the tales that he's collected when we come back. We're talking with Mike Cleland about Stories from the Messengers, his latest book about owls, synchronicities, their connections to a whole host of what we'd call paranormal experiences, alien abductions, and a lot more. And when we come back, going to have Mike share some of the stories that he's been collecting over the last 11 years. Some of them are pretty darn good. We'll be right back with more Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. My guest, Mike Cleland, is an avid outdoorsman, illustrator, and UFO researcher. But as he says in his first book, he is known far and wide as the owl guy because of all the owl-related stories that he has collected. Mike, you're okay with being the owl guy, right?
I am totally fine with being the owl guy. I think, you know, what happened, the owl guy, that, I mean, the owl found me. I didn't go seeking this. They found me, and it has been a little bit nerve-wracking at times trying to make sense of it, but it has been remarkably rewarding and remarkably, like, I don't know, I'm left with a more interesting and more a richer view of reality after trying to make sense of all these odd, unexplainable stories.
Well, that certainly comes through in both of the books. It feels like a spiritual journey, a shamanic kind of experience. Some of the experiences that you describe, the things that happen to people, are spooky. I would imagine they're downright scary at the time that they happen. But upon further reflection, for them and for you, they become something else.
Well, the process of the book, yeah, the shamanic thing that shows up over and over and over again, and that's something that I've that there's a full chapter on it in both of the books. There's a I deal directly with the shamanism thing, and it's something that shows up at the time of shamanic initiation. So, you know, which came first? You know, is the owl a totem of shamanic initiation, and that's like these people who are having what would be, let's say, I don't know what you categorize as normal UFO contact, but, you know, a UFO contact experience, is that some form of shamanic initiation? I don't have an answer for that, but I certainly wrestle with those questions in the book.
You told us before the break about this camping, hiking experience, and two different times you have these owls flying over you, and it struck you as odd or meaningful. I would assume that is because it struck a chord with you based on other experiences you had in your life. You tell about them, things that happened when you were much younger in the book.
Yes. So at 2006, when I had the events in the mountains with Kristen, the three owls, two nights in a row, or two separate nights, a few days apart, I at that point in my life, I knew I had to look into some experiences that I'd had when I was younger. And these, boy, they sure play out like UFO contact experiences. And I recognized them. I was reading UFO books at the time. I was reading books by Whitley Strieber and Bud Hopkins and John Mack. And I recognized the implications. But, man, I was not going there. I was denying it. I was not going to deal with it. And it was the owls that forced me to kind of look inward and try to make sense of these memories. And, it wasn't the memories themselves. It was the seeing those owls. And then afterwards, after that event with in the mountains with Kristen, I was seeing so many owls. It was absurd in a way how many owls I was seeing. So some of the events that from my youth as a boy, I had a very clear UFO sighting out a window with a friend. And we watched this little, it seemed small, I don't know how big it might have been. My sense, it was about the size of a van, let's say, but about a coffee can-shaped object moving through the sky. We both would have been 12 years old. I'm 55 now. That would have been 1974. And that we watched for maybe 30 seconds, and poof, it vanished. And from that point on, I felt like I could say that I had seen a UFO, and when I heard UFO reports, and read about them, I had a completely open mind, because there's nothing they were saying that I couldn't have said myself. And this other story, I did not place this in the category of UFOs at all until I heard the term missing time many years later. I was walking home from a high school football game. They had it on Friday nights in the little town I grew up in, Michigan. And I was walking home with a friend, and we got to a spot on the sidewalk. I know exactly where it was. I could go right to that spot and put an X on with chalk on right where I was standing, and there was a weird flash of light in the sky. I don't know how to explain it, except it felt like God flipped the light switch on, and the whole sky lit up orange, a rich, deep orange, the whole sky for 1 second, and then the light switch went off again. It just went right back to normal stars. It was extremely jarring and distressing. And I remember talking to my friend. We were both 12-year-old boys. This is, again, 1974. And just like, what happened? What just happened? Could it be an explosion? Could it be lightning? Nothing made sense. When I got home, my parents were angry at me. And I was like, what are you angry at me for? It's 9:30. I'm just not late. I told you I'd be home about 9:30. It's 9:30. And they're like, no, it's 11:30. So somehow I had lost 2 hours of time. I just blew past that. I was like, it didn't make any sense. So I didn't address it. It was years later when I read about missing time that story became much more distressing. I mean, and then I'll also say my friend's memory, when he retold the subject of it or the event, he described that we had seen a UFO with lights and everything. And I was just not going to go there because that wasn't my memory. And I just thought he was lying, and I just never addressed it.
You refer to people like that as the maybe people. That they've had some kind of experience, but they really don't want to press it too far to find out if it is what they think it might be, right?
Correct. Yes, and that's a term that I use because there's hundreds of stories in this book, and I don't have, like, if I was a trillionaire, I could send out a team of investigators and go through an in-depth investigation on every single person and hypnosis sessions or whatever it took, and maybe get a clearer answer, but probably not, actually. And I'm left with this, oftentimes the question I ask people, I'll ask them straight up, do you think you are a UFO abductee? And they'll go, oh, no, I'm not a UFO abductee. And then they'll go on to tell me all kinds of things that I feel like a UFO abductee would tell, stories of missing time, close a few UFO sightings, and in conjunction with those, owl sightings. So a very typical owl story is, he's in the book. He's camping in the desert. He's with a friend, and they're lying out looking at the stars, and they look up at the tall cactus, and this is in southern Arizona, and there's a owl staring down at them. And they both, and there's a campfire going, and they have this weird vibe about it. Like, it's unsettling. The owl flies off. And then moments later, a triangle-shaped craft flies directly over them and then down the canyon where they were. And I sat with him, and he struggled to articulate how weird it was flying. It wasn't. He said it was not like a conventional craft. It was absolutely perfectly silent. And then I asked him the question. He told a few more stories. He'd seen other UFOs, and I said, listen, do you think you're a UFO abductee? He says, no. And then he goes on to say, well, then I did have that dream, which felt pretty real, where I was lifted out of my bed and passed through the walls. And my girlfriend at the time said, I didn't want to open my eyes because I knew you wouldn't be in the room and they had taken you, which is a very strange thing for her to say. And he never, and then in conjunction with all of this, he said through these experiences, he had had what he refers to as a spiritual awakening. And that is something that I feel is part of this. It's not the main thread, but it is certainly part of it. And so I do have I guess there's a tone, let's say, to the way I frame this research, where I make sure to recognize those kinds of stories when they appear. When people say they've had a spiritual awakening in conjunction with their contact experiences, I mean, I see that as a pattern, because that's other people have told me this very same thing enough that I take it very seriously.
You know, the Whitley-Strieber connection is, it pops up a couple of different places. Whitley wrote the foreword to your latest book. You reference him in the first book, and I think you had written an article before it was even a book project, and somehow Whitley sees it right away and writes to you. And of course, we all think about Communion, that alien staring off the cover of Communion, that millions of people sort of reacted to that guy. They hadn't thought about alien abduction experiences until they were confronted with it, with that image on the front of that book. And they had visceral, distinct reactions to it. And that's sort of how a lot of people react to owls. At the idea that Strieber had brought up in that book, the owl connection as being a possible screen memory for an encounter with aliens, right?
Well, that would be the screen memory aspect, the way he describes it. And it's very, so I worked really hard to find a reference before Whitley Strieber's book from 1987, which isn't that long ago, but 30 years ago, 31 years ago. So there might be references out there to owls showing up in conjunction with UFO contact. I've certainly found some fiction things where they show up in movies and such, but it's pretty fleeting. It's pretty light. But that was the first place in pop culture that I found where an owl shows up in conjunction with UFO contact, with what we would now call, you know, alien abduction. So what he's describing is this kind of a memory. He wrestles with it. He's spoken about it and says he feels that there was an owl in the house. And his wife was like, well, that doesn't make any sense. It's wintertime, all the winters are closed. And he said, well, but then there was an owl out this window. And they went up to the window, and there had been no fresh snow, and there were no tracks anywhere on the windowsill or anywhere in the snow just outside the window. And when he saw that there should have been, because the snow had been there for enough days, when he saw there was no tracks, he said it made his blood run cold, because he knew that something else had happened. And that would be the screen memory aspect. I have the screen memory thing is what, like I've talked with Bud Hopkins about owls, and he puts it straight in the screen memory category and never really strayed from that. But I was having experiences with real owls. So what's happening? The perfect screen memory, here I have this one story that's really wonderful. It's in the first book. There's a woman, and she has had a lot of, she is not, like you ask her, are you a UFO abductee? She will say yes. And she's very, come to terms with it. She's very clear about it. She's not a maybe person. And she, as a young girl, she would have been 18 or 19, she was working at a summer camp and for girls. And she wasn't even off in the woods. She was like walking between two sets of buildings on a little path. And as she's walking full daylight, she turns the corner on this path. She can hear the girls playing in the background. She turns the corner, and there, standing next to the path, is a gray alien in full daylight, big black eyes. And she said she locked eyes with this thing, and it locked eyes with her, and she realized she surprised it. And it she had this, like the telepathy and the shock was so strong in a way that she had this echoing kind of voice in her head that went, owl, 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 owl. And she watched this being, this gray alien, skinny gray alien with a big bald head and the big black eyes. She watched it morph into an owl and then turn around and run into the woods. And so what do you make of that story? I mean, what can I make of that? It says that that these beings somehow have an ability to put a psychic image, a psychic projection into the mind of the observer. You know, maybe owls resemble, like, that cover of Communion. You don't have to blur your vision too much to see an owl on that cover instead of the alien with the big black eyes. So are they choosing the owl simply because it looks enough like the likeness of a gray alien? Or is there some deeper reasoning behind the symbology of the owl? Are they choosing it for a more archetypal reason?
Well, to paraphrase Freud, I guess sometimes a cigar is just a cigar. So sometimes an owl is just an owl. But you quote Whitley Strieber in the introduction to the second book, in which he says that the owl is sort of the central, in his view, the owl is the central symbol of the close encounter experience. Do you go that far? Do you agree?
Well, I'm a tough person to ask, right? Because I'm like immersed in it. I mean, that's all I do all day is answer emails about owls and alien abductions. So I'm going to answer absolutely. So I'm not objective. So yes, right. I mean, I see eye to eye with that completely. Someone else might not, but I'm completely immersed, probably more than anyone on Earth, in this owl UFO connection. So that's the owl as a symbol of UFO contact. Absolutely.
You have a story in the second book, early in the second book, related to crop circles. A couple of the what are called croppies have an experience. The crop circle is forming. They see a ball of light. They follow it. What happens?
This is I love this story. This is a fellow named Bert Jansen. I'm certain he's been on Coast to Coast before. He's a wonderful speaker. So he told a story, and about, it was right at the point. Now, this is one of the questions I ask people before they see an owl, or like it's about their owl experience or their UFO experience. I said, what was going on in your life right before this happened? Or what was going on in your life? How did your life change after this event happened? So right before this event, he said, I've been studying crop circles 3 years in a row. It's enough. I'm done. Learned all I can learn. Standing in a field, and this orange orb, this orange ball of light, not a structured flying saucer, an orange semi-translucent ball of light, floats around the field. It zips back and forth. It shrinks down tiny. It grows up big. And there's a shed at the edge of the field. And it kind of goes behind the shed. And swings, zips across. And it goes behind the shed, but it doesn't come off the other side. And he kind of knows it was kind of up high at the top of the shed. So he goes around, and he goes around and looks at the back of the shed. And right at the height that the orb would have been zipping by is a broken window. And he goes and he listens, puts his ear up to the door and goes, here's this eerie hissing noise. Yes, yes. And I give him a lot of credit. He broke into the shed like a good investigator should. He broke a lock and went into the shed. And he's standing there in this dark shed, and there's this hissing noise on the up at the top of the rafters. And he climbs up this ladder and peeks over the edge, and there's a family of barn owls. And baby barn owls make this horrible, gruesome hissing noise. So he was just like, what did I see? Like it immediately put the UFO, which was an orange ball of light, in crop circle country. It connected it with the white owl. Now there's another woman who has an amazing story that's the flip-flop of that. Her name is Maria Wheatley. She studies ley lines as well as ancient sites in New England. And her name is Wheatley, L-E-Y, Wheatley. So she goes in the wheat fields and studies ley lines. Her name is Wheatley. She has a story where she was with a friend, and they were going to go walk in the woods. And they walked down this path, and there's an owl, a white owl, crosses their path. They both immediately feel the same thing. We're not allowed here. We got to turn around. They felt it. Like, nope, we're not allowed. So they turn around and say, well, what are we going to do? Let's walk to the top of this hill. So they walk to the top of the hill. They get to the top. Beautiful view. The sunset. It's England. It's the same area. It's in crop circle country. And they see this orange dot approach them. And this orange dot gets huge, and it turns into this giant cigar-shaped glowing orange, like almost mothership, and gets closer and closer, and then shrinks down and eventually disappears. And they are both so freaked out. She said, so this is the question, what was going on in her life after? She said afterwards, she became a more powerful psychic. She was already doing things like tarot readings and stuff like that, but she said that event made her a more powerful psychic, and the fellow she was with had the same story.
Didn't one of those crop circle or English events happen on Knapp Hill? Not that we're looking for synchronicity.
Oh, yes, it did happen on Knapp Hill, yes. And it was in it. Yes, that's right. Yeah, there's a spot called Knapp Hill. And also there's another field called South Field, which is the town I grew up in, which I took a little note of that. So that's
all right. We're talking with Mike Cleland about his new book, Stories from the Messengers, Owls and Synchronicities and Possible Connections to Alien Encounters. We'll be back with more of those stories in a moment.